This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. We'll start with a story that affects boat owners in Washington and Idaho, indeed all of the states in the Union. The Coast Guard is enforcing new standards that require many boat owners to get new hull identification numbers, or HINs, for their boats. A HIN is the nautical version of the vehicle identification number, or VIN, on a car or truck, says Gary Brookshire, the service manager at Tobler Marine in Hayden, Idaho.
It's pretty much the same idea as a motor vehicle, is being able to tie that unique serial number on a boat for the hull identification number, or the HIN number, to the registered owner of the boat.
It's the way for authorities to make sure vessels are licensed properly and not stolen. The HIN is assigned to each boat by the manufacturer. It's usually posted on the back right side, and in case that's not legible, the number is also posted inside somewhere. It's not the same number you see on the boat's front hull.
The number on the front of the boat, depending on what state it's from, is the registration number for the boat issued by the state, which is much like a license plate on a car.
Licensing agencies in both states have sent notice to boat owners that their HINs may not match what's in the government records.
For example, it could be a letter or number that's been transposed, or somewhere along the line, if the number in the HIN number was actually an 8 and it's been recorded as a 3.
Take a photo or a rubbing of your hull identification number and come see one of the licensing offices. It's possible that your hull number is fine, but the record is wrong that's in the computer system, and we've had quite a few of those.
That's Spokane County Auditor Vicki Dalton, who's in charge of boat licensing in her county. If the numbers don't match, boat owners may need a new HIN. Most won't be affected, which means they've been able to or will be able to relicense their boats without any extra effort. But licensing officials in Washington estimate 19,000 boat owners will have to do that extra work. We don't have a similar estimate for Idaho. Brookshire says because Idaho boat licenses went into effect the first of the year, the Gem State's licensing agency, the Department of Parks and Recreation, has already been dealing with this.
It's been, I would say, overwhelming for them at some times, dealing with the number of boat owners they have, because that information has to be exchanged between the boat owner and the Idaho Department of Park and Recreation prior to us being able to issue a renewal.
Because Washington's boat licensing calendar is different, Dalton says boat owners in Spokane are just starting to show up in her office with their notification letters.
We're getting the entire spectrum of reactions, from people who just shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, okay, to the more common reaction of, well, how am I supposed to get this done? What am I supposed to use? And that's what's really causing the issues for the boat owners. It's not the fact they have to get a new paperwork and a new number. The issue for boat owners is having to put that new number onto their hull.
Some people are calling the dealers where they bought their boats to get that information. People such as Dan Conrath from Spokane Valley Marine.
I'm actually working on getting little metal tags like our manufacturers use, and then some way to stamp numbers in them as well.
And then owners can post the tags with the new numbers on their boats. The Washington Department of Licensing has issued instructions on its website for how to do that. When you're out with your boat this spring or summer, authorities such as Spokane County Sheriff's Deputy James Ebel will be checking to make sure you have the right HIN.
Anytime that we do an inspection, whether it's at the boat ramp or on the water, we're going to write down that hull identification number and confirm with the registration paperwork that that matches.
He won't necessarily write you a ticket if you haven't taken care of that.
Every case is going to be different. Each boat and each ownership paperwork is going to be different, but for the most part, we just want to be able to help people out and try to get this frustrating process over with.
County Auditor Vicki Dalton is urging boat owners who have received their letter from the Department of Licensing to take care of the issue now before they get on the water and get stopped. Washington Governor Jay Inslee has been busy this week and last doing an essential function of his job, signing bills into law. Most of them are targeted and will have a small impact. For example, one new law allows public transit buses to have bike racks that stick out up to 4 feet from the front of the bus. The law had limited that to 3 feet. Another new law that affects Washington State University revolves around one word, branch.
This bill strikes the word branch from all state laws that refer to satellite campuses of the public higher education system. This is in keeping with current practice and diminishes the impression that somehow these facilities were lesser than the main campuses. Thanks to Representative Haler for making this statement and the smile here.
A photographer snaps a photo of the governor with Republican Representative Larry Haler from Richland and a WSU representative. The new law applies to WSU's campuses in Spokane, the Tri-Cities, Vancouver and Everett, and to University of Washington campuses in Tacoma and Bothell. Among the bills sponsored or co-sponsored by Eastern Washington legislators include one that requires local and state public entities to fly the POW/MIA flag on two additional days throughout the year. They include Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, December 7th. That bill was co-sponsored by Spokane Valley Republican Representatives Bob McCaslin and Matt Shea. Democratic Representative Marcus Riccelli was the prime sponsor of a bill that requires all school districts to annually review their physical education programs. Okanagan County Republican Representative Joel Kretz had an especially productive session with environmental bills. He was lead sponsor of one that allows problem beavers that are causing damage to a specific area to be trapped and relocated to locales in western Washington. The law had limited relocations to spots east of the Cascades. Kretz was also lead sponsor of a bill aimed at requiring the state to consider local firefighters when it needs someone to help with wildfires.
This bill helps the state respond more quickly to wildfire, thus better protecting lives and property. It adds capacity to the Department of Natural Resources in recruiting qualified wildland fire suppression contractors and requires or allows entering into preemptive contracts with contractors who own firefighting equipment, sponsored by Representative Kretz.
Kretz also awaits the governor's signature, perhaps later this week, on his wildfire prevention bill. It directs the Department of Natural Resources to identify forested state trust lands most in need of treatment. It requires 2-year and 6-year project lists, and it creates a revolving fund to pay for those forest treatment projects. A similar bill, sponsored by Wenatchee Republican Senator Brad Hawkins, has received the governor's signature.
This bill introduces a more proactive way of reducing the risk of catastrophic forest fires by creating a forest treatment plan. It grew out of a community conversation in Wenatchee. Nearly 2.7 million acres of forest land in eastern Washington are at risk of severe damage from insects and disease, making them susceptible to catastrophic wildfires.
The new law sets a goal of treating 1 million acres of forests during the next several years. It calls for cutting trees when the density makes them susceptible to fires, prescribed burns to clear out fuel, and creating fire breaks that can stop fires from spreading. And finally, the governor on Wednesday signed into law a bill sponsored by Representative McCaslin that allows school districts to build facilities in rural areas outside of a county's established urban growth area. It further allows those counties to provide services such as water and sewer to those schools. Supporters say land within urban boundaries has become prohibitively expensive and that school districts should be allowed to search for cheaper land elsewhere. Opponents say this will promote urban sprawl. Inslee signed most of the bill but vetoed one section.
Much of the discussion has, facially, talked about the need just to help schools and not be sort of a erosion of the values of the Growth Management Act. And I am very confident that we can fashion a way to do that. The simplest way to do that is just, as I indicated in my comments, is to simply limit the infrastructure to that which is necessary to serve the school.
He hopes work can be done during the special session that began on Monday. The governor will continue to sign bills during the next 2 or 3 weeks. The question of whether the federal government will continue to provide funding for public radio and television is again before Congress. And so it was especially timely when Paula Kerger, the head of PBS, the public broadcasting service, came to town last Friday.
I'm here in Spokane to celebrate the 50th anniversary of KSPS, and it's an extraordinary milestone for the station, one of the earlier stations to sign on the air in the country. So I'm really very proud to be part of this wonderful milestone event.
This is an important symbolic year for public broadcasting in the U.S. It's not only the KSPS anniversary, it's also the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Public Broadcasting Act. That law led to the creation of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is the entity that receives federal funding and disperses it to public radio and TV stations around the country. And now, as the system evolves and the debate continues over whether federal funding is still appropriate, Kerger is reminding people about the value she believes local stations provide.
I think people may not understand that the funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting actually does not stay in Washington. It goes out to stations across this country, public television and public radio stations. And for on the television side, it represents about 15%, that's 15% of our overall revenue for our stations, but that's an aggregate number. Here in Spokane, it represents about 18% of KSPS's budget. In some parts of the country, in Alaska, for example, it represents about 60%. So we make a very specific argument for the continued support of federal funding because it, in fact, does affect the very existence of a number of stations in our system, particularly in rural areas. When the federal funding was first put together for public broadcasting, it was envisioned as being a part of a public-private partnership, and our stations work very hard to try to raise money, as you hear on radio with the fundraising drives or see on KSPS for their fundraising as well. And I think, as you look back over the last 50 years, it's been an extraordinarily effective public-private partnership. For about $1.35 per taxpayer per year, we're able to provide, I think, an extraordinary service. And so in order to preserve that service, particularly for the rural stations, we are really making a great effort to make sure legislators understand the risk if that money goes away.
But if that money stays, Kerger says public broadcasting will continue to serve new audiences, not just through over-the-air TV, but in other places people go for information.
As we look at this very dynamic media landscape where there are many ways that people are now hoping to experience their programming. I mean, a lot of us come home at night and they turn on a television set in a living room or in a family room or in a kitchen and watch, but people are also increasingly watching on their tablets, they're watching on their smartphones. And we need to fulfill that that need. If people want to look for us in different places, then we need to make sure that we're there. We're also continuing to look at new audiences to serve. We just launched a 24-hour children's channel.
I'm Judy.
And I'm Adam. We're engineers.
We work with kids.
This is so cool.
To make their dreams come true through engineering.
Because there are so many children that live in homes without computers or without books but have access to television. And, you know, there's such a crying need in this country for pre-K education and for the many children who will never see the inside of a pre-K classroom to be able to have access to content that will give them the basic skills to succeed as they enter school, to be excited about learning. That's a big piece of what we do at PBS. And so putting together this 24-hour channel so that we have content available, education, curriculum-based material for young children that's available in the evenings and on weekends as well as during the day is an important part of our mission. And as we look to expand and look forward, obviously having the federal funding behind us makes a big difference in our ability to meet all those needs. We created it as a broadcast channel. It is available on cable. It is also available streamed. And so you can watch it on your smartphone or on your tablet or on your computer. And the streaming version will later this year also include games that are built into the streams, which is significant for children's programming because the games actually extend the educational experience for children. And so it is very much a project that is built on what has been the legacy of public broadcasting broadcast, as well as using the new tools and technology that exist now to really expand the reach of those programs.
Whether or not public broadcasting retains federal funding, Kerger believes PBS will continue to provide programs that people will watch and talk about.
You know, when I look back over the 11 years that I've been in this job, the range of programs that we have brought forward from some of Ken Burns' great work. In fact, his next big project with Lynn Novick on the Vietnam War broadcasts this fall. But I've also been proud of the fact that in the 11 years we've moved from about 16th most watched of all broadcasters to 6, and with a range of programs that really meet the needs and interests of a wide range of people, recommitment to the arts, a deep dive into history and science, and of course our ongoing work in the news and public affairs space. The series that I'm the proudest of that's on our air is Frontline, which I think consistently makes an important contribution to civic discourse.
And now with talk about federal funding again in the news, Kirger says it's a good chance for supporters to offer their thoughts about what the future of public broadcasting should be.
What has made the difference is when people in communities, constituents, have reached out to legislators to express their opinion about the future of funding. Look, I'm very sympathetic that legislators have very difficult decisions to make about funding priorities. And if this is something that's important to you, then there's a very specific way that you can let your voice be heard, and that's by reaching out to your legislators to let them know how you feel.
That's PBS President Paula Kirger speaking last week with SBR's Steve Jackson in Spokane. So where are you going to vacation this summer? More and more people are choosing to stretch beyond the traditional themes, the beach, camping, theme parks, and trying things that challenge them physically, mentally, and emotionally. This month, members of the Adventure Travel Trade Association held their annual conference in Coeur d'Alene to talk about the changes in their industry. The organization's strategic director for North America is Russell Walters. He says adventure travel is no longer just for the fittest of the fit.
You know, 10 years ago, adventure travel was sort of defined as risky, exciting. It might have focused on, you know, real hardcore energetic activities. And today, the adventure traveler wants to sort of have a more immersive experience. They want to, you know, travel to this place to recreate. They want to travel to this place to be active. But they also want to travel to understand and learn about different cultures. So there's been a maturing, I think, of the adventure travel market, which in and of itself has helped to sort of broaden the appeal and broaden the growth of the market.
What are the challenges in adventure travel right now?
Capacity. Make sure that we don't have too many people in any one location, that we're preparing our adventurers and the communities appropriately. So that, you know, people are well prepared and well versed when they go out and experience landscapes, destinations, different cultures.
Russell Walters is the strategic director for North America for the Adventure Travel Trade Association. One subset of adventure travel is indigenous tourism. That's travel to areas owned or traditionally occupied by indigenous people. Danae Sinclair will tell us more about that. She is the marketing director for the Aboriginal Tourism Association of Canada, which works with tour operators north of the border. She spoke at the Coeur d'Alene conference earlier this month.
Tourism can be a great opportunity for economic sovereignty in a community if it's done right, and there's certain ways to do it right. And there are some communities that have not had success, and it's interesting to look at some of those challenges that have happened. There are communities that potentially don't want to have visitors. And so we talked a little bit about maybe why that is, and maybe to the ability for these tour companies to, present themselves in a way that can really have an understanding of the benefit that that community wants. Because sometimes that's not just about coming there and spending your money. Sometimes the objectives of the community is about, you know, cultural sustainability or employment for the young people or, you know, language revitalization. And sometimes tourism can have a role in that, but it is up to the community to decide what that relationship could look like. So I think that, you know, the tour companies want to be able to have those kinds of beneficial relationships to both sides.
Part of that relationship involves teaching each other how to act around one another.
As a host, you want to set up that relationship to succeed. So part of, we didn't discuss it in my presentation, but part of the resources that we provide isn't just to tour operators that want to visit Indigenous communities, but also to Indigenous communities that want to look at tourism. And so what does that community need to provide in order to say, you know, our doors are open and you're welcome here? And part of that is communicating to a guest what is appropriate, what are the rules. If you're coming to our community, you know, we ask that that you do this or you do that, or you don't do this or you don't do that. That is also part of being a good host.
Denae Sinclair says travel to Indigenous areas is not just about building amenities, trying to get people to come and spend their money, take a few pictures, and leave.
That's not the kind of travel that a lot of these companies are offering or really wanting to talk about. They're wanting to talk about those experiences that you have that really, really are changing your life. And a lot of it had to do with, you know, one-on-one connections where people, you know, met someone in another country, an Indigenous person or not, but had that one-on-one connection that really changed your perspective and outlook on things.
How much do the political events, whether it be terrorism-related or just blustering by politicians, how much does that affect the area that you work in?
You know, certainly I think there's a movement overall in travel right now to for people looking for connections. And, you know, researchers chalk that up to social media and, you know, the lack of connection we have in our life, or is it chalked up to fear and, you know, concern about not knowing our neighbors or not knowing who to trust. And so people are hungry for those human connections. And so that's the travel that that we're talking about here. And so I think there's a lot of things you can chalk that up to, but certainly political climate might be part of it as well.
Is there a demographic that is more or less dominant here? Is it younger people who are more involved in this? Is it baby boomers like me? Or is it a nice mix of folks?
It is a mix of folks because also in the adventure realm, there is everything from, you know, doing more active travel to a younger person who really wants to be more on that, more physically active, or is adventure travel really just doing something outside your realm of comfort? And so something adventurous could be food related. Something adventurous could be, you know, cultural exchange related.
You can visit the website of Sinclair's organization at aboriginalcanada.ca. And if you're looking for travel ideas, she says you can find some there, about 60 experiences across Canada.
That could be great add-ons or, you know, standalone experiences. If you're already planning a trip to Vancouver, for example, we have a number of members in Vancouver that can maybe show you a different side of the city, because it's not, Indigenous people are not just, you know, in remote locations in these sort of these untouched wilderness areas. That more than half the Indigenous people in Canada live in urban centers. And so that's also an important thing for people to see, that when you're visiting especially Canada and you go to a major center, there's other sides to that urban city that you can learn about and connect with.
Denae Sinclair is the marketing director for the Aboriginal Tourism Association of Canada. She spoke at a conference on adventure and Indigenous tourism in Coeur d'Alene earlier this month. A quick thanks to all of the people who called with pledges during Spokane Public Radio's just-completed pledge drive. We appreciate your support and look forward to continuing to serve you. Thanks to TVW for some of the sound in this program. You can listen to Inland Journal online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Go to the Inland Journal page. I'm Doug Nadvornik. We'll be back same time next week with another edition of the Inland Journal.